University, and he's now currently at Griffith University. So among his interests, there is, of course, Bohmian theory and the study of quantum equilibrium, or quantum non-equilibrium, as we will see in today's talk, which is entitled Sub-Compton Quantum Non-Equilibrium and Majorana Systems.
Please. Thanks, Giulio. All right, thanks everyone for coming. So as Giulio said, I'm going to talk about the sub-Compton quantum non-equilibrium in Majorana systems. And so during the next few slides, I'm going to explain the meaning of this title and the specific question that I would like to address today. So our work on the Brell-Bohm pilot wave theory. And for those who don't know the theory, so basically it says that the... Is there like a hockey stick? It's okay. I'll do without. So basically, this theory says that the complete description of a particle is not only given by a wave function psi tx, but also by a particle position xt. And if you have a full ensemble in this theory, the full ensemble is not only described by psi tx, but also by a distribution of particle position. And the distribution of particle position, that would be rho tx. Also in this theory, the wave function always evolves according to the Schrödinger equation. And the guidance equation for xt is chosen in such a way that if you start from an ensemble in which the particle position are distributed according to psi squared for some initial time t0, they will remain distributed according to psi squared for any later time t. And in the most simplest case, the guidance equation, which is going to ensure this property, that simply this one over here, the velocity of the particle is defined as the standard quantum mechanical current J divided by psi squared. And that's the guidance equation. And another definition, that's the notion of quantum equilibrium. So a quantum equilibrium distribution, it simply means an ensemble in which the particle positions are distributed according to psi squared. That's all it means. An equilibrium, because once you have this distribution at some initial time t0, you have it for any later time t. And as an example, we can consider the double slit experiment in the Brell-Bohm pilot wave theory. So as you see, in this theory, you have both the wave and the particle position. So the wave is going to go through both slits. It's going to interfere. And at each point in space, it defines a velocity field, which is going to guide the particle. So basically, if you specify the initial position of the particle, then the trajectory is fully determined by the equations of motion. And if you repeat the experiment many times, the particle position are going to be distributed according to psi squared at the level of the slits. And if you repeat the experiment many times, they are going to arrange themselves according to psi squared at the screen level. And that's why you reproduce the pattern that is well known in quantum mechanics. So the interesting thing about this theory, the Brell-Bohm pilot wave theory, it's the notion of quantum non-equilibrium. It's an idea which has been explored by Anthony Valentini. And what this idea says is simply that you can consider ensemble in which the particle positions are not distributed according to psi squared. So that's what quantum non-equilibrium means. And of course, if you take this idea seriously, and if there was quantum non-equilibrium at some point in the history of the universe, here's the stick. Thanks.
You're welcome.
So if you take this idea seriously of quantum non-equilibrium, and if there was quantum non-equilibrium at some point in the history of the universe, you have to explain why we don't see quantum non-equilibrium around us today. And the way this is done is by invoking this idea of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And what this concept means is that if you start from an ensemble, a quantum non-equilibrium ensemble, and if you let it evolve, then the particle positions are going to redistribute themselves according to psi squared. And that's what this relation means. And it's going to hold at the coarse grain level. So here you have a numerical simulation which illustrates this concept of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And so these simulations were done by Valentini and Westman. So Hans was also a postdoc at PI. And what they did was to consider a scalar particle in a two-dimensional box. So here you have, in the right column, you have psi squared for time t0, time t equal to pi, and time t equal 4 pi. And on this column, you have the non-equilibrium distribution. And so the time evolution goes like this. So you see, at the initial time t0, they don't look alike. But as time evolves, the non-equilibrium distribution is going to relax to the quantum equilibrium distribution. And in this simulation, a small coarse graining is done in order to see this process happening. So if you take this idea of quantum non-equilibrium as a real possibility, standard quantum mechanics, that's only a special class of the Broadbohm pilot wave theory. So, yes? There is no, like, you mean theoretical? No. All the, well, there is the EH theorem by Anthony that gives some support, by Anthony Valentini, that gives some support to this idea, but I think that the soundest proof for me is the numerical simulation. Also, they don't rule the labs. No. Okay. No, here there's an example of a non-equilibrium. Here basically you simply take the double slit experiment and you restrict the support of the non-equilibrium distribution on the lower slit. That's what you would see if you do this experiment. You have examples like if you take an energy eigenstate, for instance, that's not going to relax. A Gaussian wave packet, that's not going to relax. You have a few very simple examples in which you don't have relaxation. So you need enough complexity in your system to see the process happening. Like here, you need to, I think that 16 energy eigenstates being superposed for the wave function. But if you would only have, let's say, one energy eigenstate, you would not see relaxation.
It's also true that if you had all of the wave on a node of the wave function, for example, if your row was in a small set of possibilities, it also wouldn't relax.
Yes, because relaxation doesn't hold at the it's related to this idea that you have to do this coarse graining. And at the trajectory, at the level of the trajectory, you don't see relaxation to quantum equilibrium. Yeah, that's true.
I'm just saying that it's true for most distributions, row, but not all distributions.
No. Of course. It's you have wave function for which no matter what row you choose, you won't see relaxation. And as you say, you have example of non-equilibrium distribution for which you won't see. That's correct. And well, the interesting thing in the Debreu-Blum parallel wave theory, that's the new physics that can come out from quantum non-equilibrium and lead to predictions which are different from standard quantum mechanics. And also a few has been done regarding relaxation to quantum equilibrium and relativistic systems. So recently I've looked at the Dirac equation, and now I'm looking at the Majorana equation. And for those who don't know the Majorana's work, I'm just going to cite this quote here. I think it summarizes accurately the work of Majorana. So Majorana's most important scientific work appeared in a 1932 Novocimento paper, motivated by the desire to find a replacement for the Dirac equation that would solve the problem of its negative energy states, a problem which disappeared in 1932 with the discovery of the positron. In this paper, Majorana investigated for the first time infinite dimensional representation of the Lorentz group, ones whose role in physics, if any, remains mysterious. As part of this work, he discovered the possibility of a real representation of the Clifford algebra, and thus a version of the Dirac equation in which a particle is its own antiparticle. So here in this talk, I'm going to be concerned about the second part, so the Majorana equation. And so the Majorana equation, if you start from the Dirac equation, so Majorana found a representation for the gamma matrices in which all the matrices are purely imaginary. So it means that this set of equations reduce to a set of four equations with real coefficients. And so they can be satisfied by a real spinor without the need for complex number. And in turn, this spinor could describe a fermion, which is its own antiparticle. And it could be a candidate to describe, for instance, the neutrino. Like the neutrino, we still don't know whether they are like a Dirac spinor or Majorana spinor. That's still an open question. And also, this equation is relevant in various other fields, like supersymmetry, like condensed matter, quantum information. And in fact, Franz Wilczek wrote an article in 2009 in which he discusses the relevance of the Majorana equation in all these fields. And the article is called Majorana Returns. It's related to the disappearance of the title is related to the disappearance of Majorana in 1938. So as I'm going to show in this talk, if you look at the Majorana equation from the point of view of the Debreu-Blum pilot wave theory, the surprising thing is that the B-able has to move luminally. Despite the fact that the mass appears in the equation of motion. And also on a coarse grain level, the trajectory gives the impression of moving subluminally. And the way it achieves this is by undergoing like helical trajectory at the speed of light. And so you can give the impression that the coarse grain trajectory has an overall velocity slower than the speed of light.
What sets the scale?
I forgot to. So the scale, that's the Compton wavelength of the. So here I'm going to explain these are various trajectories for different masses. And like the larger the mass, the smaller the diameter of the helix. And the diameter is simply the Compton wavelength, where mass is simply the one which appears in the equation there. But so you see that in the pilot wave theory, the trajectory is highly constrained at the Compton wavelength scale. And the idea was the following. Let's say you have so let's consider a two-dimensional system. So you have side against side on the right hand side, and here you have the non-equilibrium distribution. So if the B-able is moving like this, how is it going to affect the process of relaxation to quantum non-equilibrium if you look at the Compton wavelength scale? So basically, that's the question that I would like to address in this talk. Well, if you if you look at, let's say, if you have small like irregularities when you look at the Compton wavelength scale or below the Compton wavelength scale.
So what do you mean by look?
Well, you know, when you do the relaxation, you have to do this coarse grinding, so you have to choose a length for the. In order to define the coarse grain size squared and coarse grain non-equilibrium distribution. So let's say I take the coarse graining length to be the Compton scale. Will I see some residual non-equilibrium will I see some residual non-equilibrium if I do the relaxation? So that's the idea of the. Of this work. So that's the outline of the talk. So I'm just going to set up the basic notations for relativistic wave equation. Then I'll show how to construct the pilot wave theory for the Majorana equation. And finally, I'll discuss what would be a good system in order to perform relaxation simulation for both Dirac and Majorana equation. And then finally, the conclusion. Of this work. Okay. So the Dirac equation, it's here you have the gamma matrices, and they need to satisfy this anti-commutation relation, where eta mu nu is simply the Minkowski metric. So you have a conserved four current, and it is given by this quantity. And if you take the zero component of the current, it's going to be equal to psi dagger psi, and that's simply the probability density to find the Dirac particle at some position x at time t. And here I will work with the so-called Weyl representation for the gamma matrices. And they are defined by this equation, where sigma mu nu is defined here. So sigma zero, that's simply the identity, and sigma one, sigma two, sigma three, the usual polymatrices. And if you have a tilde over the sigma here, then that means that for sigma tilde zero, you keep the identity. But for the sigma tilde 1, 2, and 3, you simply take the minus the minus sign in front of the polymatrices. And the name Weyl representation comes from the fact that if you put mass equal to zero in the Dirac equation, it's going to split into, and if you write the Dirac spinor as psi L and psi R, and if you put mass equal to zero, then the Dirac equation is going to split into a pair of Weyl equations, which are independent and which describe massless spinors of opposite ellipticities. And if you also, I will denote the plane wave solution by UR, UL, VL, and VR. So U means that it's a positive energy plane wave solution. And the V means that it is a negative energy plane wave solution. And R means that it is an eigenstate of ellipticity, right-handed eigenstate of ellipticity. And of course, L means left-handed eigenstate of the ellipticity. And here, chi R and chi L are respectively eigenstate of the ellipticity operator with eigenvalue plus one and minus one. The last notion that I need regarding the Dirac equation is the notion of a charge conjugation. So basically, when you have the Dirac equation, if you take this idea that you have positive and negative energy solution, you have to choose a sign. Usually, what is done, all the fermions have charm minus E. And if you have a hole in the C of negative energy solution, you are going to reinterpret this as a positron. But you can do the reverse. You could say all the particles have a charge plus E, and I'm going to interpret a hole in a C of negative energy, positively charged fermion, as an electron. So you have these two possibilities. And basically, the charge conjugation is going to tell you how to relate the spinor psi to its charge conjugate that would describe a positron. And the way to do this is by taking the complex conjugate of the initial spinor and multiplying it by I time gamma 2. Where gamma 2, that's the in the Weyl representation, that's sigma 2 and minus sigma 2. Okay, so that's all I need regarding the Dirac spinor. So instead of working like Majorana with a purely imaginary representation of the gamma matrices, I'm going to work with the Weyl representation and look for solutions which are invariant on the charge conjugation. And I'm going to call these the Majorana solution. And I can build these by starting from a Dirac solution. And if it is not invariant on the charge conjugation, I simply add I time gamma 2 times the complex conjugate, and I get the solution in the end, which is invariant on the charge conjugation. And these are the Majorana solution, at least in this talk. Now, how to do the pilot wave theory for the Majorana equation? Well, you simply say that the spinor is not the complete description of your system, but that you need to add an extra position variable, x, m, mt. And in order to define the equation of motion for this quantity, you do as always, you compute the standard current, and you take the velocity of your B able to be the special part of the current divided by J0. And that's going to ensure that the so-called, that if you start from an ensemble in which the position are distributed according to Born's rule for some initial time T0, they will be distributed according to Born's rule for any later time, any later time T. And basically, you can show that if you have this additional constraint on your Majorana spinor, that is, if this quantity is invariant on the charge conjugation, the current is going to simplify. Well, the expression for the current is simplified. And in fact, it only involves half of the component of your spinor. Well, you could also write it in terms of psi L. But once you know psi L, you know psi R. That's what the Majorana constraints tells you. And that's why you can simplify the expression for the current. And in the end, you get a so-called Weyl current for the Majorana solution. And these Weyl currents have the property to be light-like. And therefore, if you compute the velocity, you find that the velocity of the Majorana B able needs to be equal to 1. And also another thing that I would like to stress is that I work with the Majorana equation, but I'm not talking about Majorana particles yet. So all the work that I've been doing, it's first quantization. So if you want to talk about Majorana neutrinos, you have to go to the second quantized level. And so now I'm going to consider a few simple examples in which I compute the trajectory for both the Dirac solution and for the Majorana solution. And the simplest case that you can consider, that's the case of a plane wave solution. So here I have a plane wave solution for a Dirac particle. It's a right-handed Dirac particle. And it moves along the z direction with constant velocity. And if you do the Brillouin-Palotoueff theory for this example, you would find out that the particle moves along the z axis with some constant velocity, and that the velocity is simply given by the momentum p divided by the energy of your particle. Now you can do the same thing for the Majorana solution. You start from the same plane wave solution, but you add its charge conjugate in order to define the Majorana solution. And it looks like the previous case, except that you have two new terms here for the x and I component. And you can also verify that the current that you have here is light-like. J0 square minus G1 square minus G2 square minus G3 square is going to be equal to zero. And in that simplest case, you can solve the equation of motion for the Majorana B able. And you find that you have an helical trajectory at light speed, and that the radius of the helix is equal to, not the radius, the diameter of the helix is equal to the Compton wavelength. So here you have the two trajectories, you have the Dirac solution, and here you have the Majorana solution moving at high speed along an ellipse and giving the impression, the overall impression that the motion is subliminal. You can also consider superposition of plane wave solutions. So here I have a superposition of three plane waves for Dirac. These are Dirac plane waves. And I do the same trick. I compute the trajectory for the Dirac solution and for the Majorana solution. And so you have these two trajectories. They really look alike. The blue one, that's the Dirac solution. And you have the red one, which corresponds to the Majorana solution. And if you look closer, well, you see that the difference here is that the Majorana solution, again, is going to move at light speed and by undergoing this helical trajectory. What you can do also is take the same initial condition, but vary the mass parameters. And here I have a set of four mass parameters, 36, 18, 9, and 6. And I'm varying the time for each simulation in order to have, let's say, the same length for each of the trajectory. And for mass 6, you have this one here. For mass 9, you have the purple one. Then for the yellow one, that's 18. And the red one, that's 36. And roughly, this simulation seems to agree with the fact that the ellipse diameter should be the Compton wavelength. But for this, I have no proof. That's just by looking at the trajectory that you can see if this seems to be the case or not. It's also funny that even if you vary the mass, they seem to undergo, like for a certain lapse of time, they seem to undergo exactly the same trajectory. So also, I don't know why they did this.
You have the proof in the earlier slides where you showed us.
Oh, that's
expression.
Yes. No. Yeah. That's the only case in which I have a proof. Yeah. There you can see that the Compton wavelength. That's.
What were the conditions in that case? Just not a superposition of plane wave.
Yes. Just a single plane wave.
Okay.
Yeah. This there you can see analytically what it's. To be honest, I didn't really look. Well, for this case, I saw that this was the case. Maybe I should just, compute the other one like explicitly and just see if, let's say for two plane waves, can I derive it explicitly? But I haven't done that. Like, well, for me, the simulations were enough to justify the. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about these Majorana solutions. Now I'm going back to this idea of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And the first thing that I want to stress is that in the Dobrev-Bohm pilot wave theory, this ratio. So the non-equilibrium density divided by psi squared is going to be preserved along a trajectory. And so if you have, let's say, if I consider some time t and some position x, I can solve the equation of motion in order to find the position x0 from which the particles comes from at the initial time t0. And if I use this property, I know that rho tx is going to be equal to rho t0 x0 divided by psi squared at time t0 x0 multiplied by psi tx. But and then you can see that if you don't do any coarse grading, that you cannot have relaxation, because if these two quantities are different at the initial time t0, automatically rho tx is going to be different from psi squared. And that's where the coarse grading is going to play a role in the argument. And how do you do this coarse grading when you do a numerical simulation? You simply take a box and you sample your box uniformly. And for each of these, for this point xi, you can find the initial condition from which it originates. And this is referred to as backtracking. So you find, you know txi, and you find out, let's say, t0 and the initial position, which is a function of xi. And if you use this property, you can compute each of the rho txi, and you simply average over all of them, and you get the value for the coarse grain density. And this is illustrated in this diagram. So I have my coarse graining box. I take a sample of positions. For each of these positions, I find the initial condition from which they came from, and then I can compute the coarse grain non-equilibrium density. But if you look at this diagram, you have two situations. You have one situation in which all the trajectories are clumped together. And this would be a really bad scenario for relaxation to quantum equilibrium, because if all the trajectories are clumped together, basically it means like a single trajectory. And since relaxation cannot hold at the level of the trajectory, so there's not going to be a good scenario for a fast relaxation. So this illustrates the fact that you need some chaos in the dynamics in order to have a fast relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And like very early, chaos was thought to be provided by the nodes of the wave function. At least if you consider non-relativistic scalar particles, nodes were thought to be the real origin of chaos in the dynamics. And this is the reason is the following: if you start from you have two particles, the initial conditions are very similar. At some point, they are going to hit a node. And they will start to spin around the node and get ejected at various times. And that's where the divergence comes from. And also, nodes are the only source of vorticity at least in the non-relativistic case. You can only have a vorticity where you have nodes. So typically, the relaxation time is going to be determined by the distribution of nodes that you have in your system. And so let's consider first the non-relativistic case and see how many nodes we typically expect. So if you have a two-dimensional system, you are going to have nodes where the real part of the wave function is equal to zero, and where the imaginary part of the wave function is equal to zero. So basically, each of these equations defines, well, in 2D, they define a curve. And you are going to have nodes where these two curves intersect. So typically, in 2D, you expect a few nodes. If you go to three dimension, you typically expect nodal lines, because each of these condition defines a surface, and you find nodes where the two surfaces intersect. But now let's do the same argument for a Dirac spinor. So a Dirac spinor is going to have four components, psi1, psi2, psi3, psi4. And you are going to find nodes where eight conditions need to be satisfied. And so typically for spinors, if you have a single Dirac spinor, you don't expect any nodes. And so apparently you have a paradox. So if you consider a Dirac spinor, and if you typically don't expect any nodes, what is going to provide a fast relaxation to quantum equilibrium? And the solution comes from the fact that the velocity field for the Dirac case has vorticity even in the absence of nodes. And that's the vorticity which is providing a fast relaxation for Dirac spinor in this case. So this argument with the distribution of nodes shows that it's interesting to the relaxation simulation for relativistic systems, because you don't expect, well, you don't have the same sources for chaos in non-relativistic system and relativistic systems. And now if you look at the Majorana solution with respect to the Dirac solution, you impose an additional constraint. You impose that the Majorana solution is invariant on the charge conjugation. And you can expect that this additional constraint is going to impose more regularity in the dynamics. You have many examples like this. For instance, if you consider the hydrogen atom in the non-relativistic de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory, and if you restrict yourself to a superposition of modes with m equal to zero, you will find out that the motion of the particle, of the electron, takes place in a plane. And as I have shown with the simulation for Majorana solution, moreover, the Majorana solution is highly constrained at the Compton wavelength scale. So it might be that, as I've explained in the beginning, that residual non-equilibrium is still preserved if you look at the Compton wavelength scale. No, the question is, what would be a good system in order to study these relaxation simulations? So what I would like to do is to do simulation for both Dirac solution and for their Majorana counterparts, and compare the relaxation time in both systems. So here, the next element is that I think that you, in order to have meaningful simulations, you really need to do 3D simulations. Because if you restrict yourself to two dimensions, nodes can appear for Majorana solutions. However, these nodes are untypical in three dimensions. So if they are untypical in three dimensions, and if you do a simulation in 2D in which nodes can appear, that's not really meaningful. So that's why you need to go to three dimensions. The other thing is that you need a confined system. And the reason is simple. You cannot simply compute the non-equilibrium, the value of the non-equilibrium distribution in all the points in R3. You need to confine your system. But the problem with the fermions is that you cannot simply put these in a box. Like, for instance, there is a theorem, I think by Thaler, which shows that if you have a superposition of positive energy solution for a Dirac spinor, then the support is necessarily non-compact. So there is a problem in confining the fermion. The other thing is that you need to have a system with the charge conjugation symmetry in order to be able to start from a Dirac solution and build the Majorana solution. And this excludes a spherical potential in the Dirac equation. So for instance, you could say that the following situation is meaningful. So you have a ball, and you add to the Dirac equation a spherical step potential in order to confine your fermion. So you have something like VR, and you have minus V0 from R equal to 0 to R, and for all the radiuses larger than R, you have 0. But if you add this potential in the Dirac equation, it's going to break the charge conjugation symmetry. So the only toy model that I found in the end was to take a Dirac equation with position-dependent mass. So I have two mass scales. I have a small mass scale M and a larger mass scale capital M. And I have a ball of radius R. And inside the ball, I say that the mass of the Dirac fermion is given by small m, and outside it's given by large m. And this system is going to preserve charge conjugation. And that's a model that high energy physicists use in order to study the confinement of fermions. So it looks like a plausible total model if you want to study this relaxation simulation for both Dirac and Majorana solutions. And the next thing that you have to check is that the helical nature of the trajectory is preserved. Otherwise, all the conjecture is... you can forget all the conjecture if you lose the helical nature of the trajectory for your system. And of course, when you do the coarse graining in the end, you need to choose a coarse graining length smaller than the helix diameter. Otherwise, you would totally wash out the residual non-equilibrium, if any, by doing this coarse graining. So that's the system that I've considered in the end. So you have the Dirac equation with a position dependent mass. So for a radius smaller than capital R, you have small m, and for a radius larger than capital R, you have large m. You can choose a set of observables that commute with h, with the Hamiltonian. So you have the so-called Dirac operator kappa. You have the total angular momentum j, and you have the third component of the angular momentum, of the total angular momentum, J3. And the next trick is to look for energy eigenvalues E, which are larger than small m, but smaller than the large m. Because if you do this, you can show that the expression for the spinor simplify a lot, and they only involve a spherical Bessel function of the first kind and modify spherical Bessel function of the second kind of integer order. But these have nice expressions in terms of cosinus, sinus, and exponentials. So basically, you can compute the expression for the spinors easily. The next thing that you need to do is to match the interior solution with the exterior solution at the boundary. And this is going to provide an equation which fixes the energy eigenvalues. But these energy eigenvalues have to be found out numerically. So I found this solution, and I've considered the superposition of eight modes. And the modes are described here with their corresponding eigenvalues. And I've also considered different set of parameters. Like small m is always one, but I've played a bit with the larger value with capital M. And also in the superposition, I take each energy eigenstate to have equal weight in the superposition. So once I add the system, first I check that you still have the helical nature for the trajectory of the Majorana solution. And as you can see, you still have something like this. And you also have that the diameter of the helix is comprised between the two length scales, which are determined by these two values of the mass. So roughly, if you look at the simulation on the next slide, the diameter is somewhere between two-thirds and one. And the next thing that you need to choose for your simulation is a non-equilibrium distribution. And I took one which didn't depend on theta or phi, and which had a radial cosine profile. So the non-equilibrium distribution, the initial non-equilibrium distribution, doesn't depend on theta or phi, and it has some profile like this, and it vanishes at R equal to capital R. Okay, maybe am I running low with the 5 minutes? Okay, I'm about yeah sure. So for each of these simulations, each square is in fact a cube. So I'm taking a slice in this three-dimensional system, and I'm taking a slice from z equal minus 0.5 up to z equal to 0.5. And each of these square corresponds to a slice in this three-dimensional system. Is that clear? Or? No? So I just mean that so I have this big ball. So I have my system here, and I'm taking a slice around z equal to zero, and I'm dividing this in cubes. And each cube seen from the top is what you see on the simulation here. And for each of these cubes, I take about 27,000 points in order to build the value of the non-equilibrium density.
What does it represent? You have four boxes on that
curve. Ah, okay. So here on the, so that's the Dirac simulation, the simulation for the Dirac system, and that's the simulation for the Majorana system. Here there's the non-equilibrium distribution, and here there's the standard quantum mechanics, that's side
this is what you see after 300
time steps. Yes. Yeah.
So
yes. But so the question is it better for Majorana? Is it better for Majorana versus Dirac? So which one is going to relax faster than the other? And will there be non-equilibrium distribution left in the Majorana system? So, well, this is like a refined version of the older plot in which I use like overlapping cube in order to interpolate between the cubes. And you see, well, it simply gives you nicer pictures. But no, let's look at the difference for here I have two plots in which I take the difference between psi squared, well, psi dagger psi and the non-equilibrium distribution. And I do this in the Majorana case, and I do this in the Dirac case. And red means that you have excess value, and blue means that you have like lower, you have negative values, and green means that means zero. That the non-equilibrium distribution is roughly equal to the to psi squared. Well, you see, it's slightly worse in the case of the Majorana system. So that's another simulation for another set of parameters. And again, in this case, the Majorana non-equilibrium distribution looks slightly worse than psi squared with respect to the Dirac one. And you can see it if you do like a plot of the difference. And that's the same system going from t equal 200 to t equal 300. And there you still have remnants of, it's still again worse in the Majorana case. But of course, that doesn't mean that if I go to time t 400, t 500, maybe all these discrepancies are going to vanish, and I'm going to have maybe that's a possibility. I'm going to have a situation in which the Majorana system is coming towards the relaxation to quantum equilibrium. So that's my last slide. So I've also looked at the, as I said, like if you want a fast relaxation to quantum equilibrium, the basic ingredient that's chaos in the dynamics. So I've looked at chaos for both Dirac solution and Majorana solutions. And surprisingly, like in most simulations that I did, you could see that the chaos was more evident in the Dirac case compared to the Majorana case. So here in the Majorana case, you have four trajectories which start very close together, and you see for a very long time they are going to stick as a bunch. And that's not good for relaxation to quantum equilibrium. Another example, that's four modes. So you start from four Dirac particles here, very close together, and they are going to diverge quickly. If you do the same simulation for the Majorana system, well, you see at time T500, they are still, despite the fact that they have these like very complicated trajectories, they still bunch up together up to T equal 500. And this absence, it's not really an absence of chaos, but the fact that you have less chaos for the Majorana system, that explains why the relaxation to quantum equilibrium is taking a longer time with respect to the Dirac case. So my conclusion. So to summarize, I have illustrated the peculiar nature of the Majorana trajectory. So the fact that it's always luminal and that it is helical if you have the right set of parameters. I think that from this simulation, it's safe to say that Majorana distribution, non-equilibrium distribution are going to relax more slowly with respect to their Dirac counterparts. But at this stage, it's still unwarranted to claim that, of course, that non-equilibrium is going to be preserved at the subquantum scale. I still have to do some work to see, most likely they are going to relax to quantum equilibrium, but you would have to wait a longer time. So that's something that I need to do more work on this. And as a byproduct, this work also shows that non-equilibrium distribution guided by Dirac spinor relax quite efficiently if you look at three-dimensional systems. That's it.
What would be the most exciting thing you could find in this kind of research?
Well,
biggest implications.
Well, right in the beginning, I thought that this Majorana equation would describe Majorana neutrinos, and of course, the first idea was okay, maybe these Majorana neutrinos, if they were in non-equilibrium distribution, let's say. From the beginning of the universe, and if you have this system, and if non-equilibrium is still preserved today, and if you could find these relic non-equilibrium hypothetical Majorana and neutrinos, you could use them to test. Well, that was the first basic idea, but of course.
So then it's good if you have a slow relaxation.
Well, no, maybe it would mean that even if you look sufficiently close, that you still have this non-equilibrium distribution. Here, what this research shows up to now is that relaxation is slower for Majorana, with Majorana system. And of course, as I said, I'm looking here at the Majorana equation from the point of view of the first quantization. But in order to study Majorana and neutrinos, you still have to go to the second quantiles. You have to go to quantum field theory. That's not clear that these results are going to be relevant there too.
If you do the quantum field theory version of the program, then you go from particles to fields.
You could keep let's say point light behaviors, but the problem is that. The problem is the following. Let's consider like neutral particles, neutral bosons. They are described by a real Klein-Gordon field. But that doesn't mean that the wave function of the boson itself is neutral. Only the field is neutral, but not necessarily the wave function of the particle. And here you have the the similar problem for the Majorana condition. When you go to quantum field theory, you impose this condition to field. And the question is the research that I'm doing for the first quantized Majorana equation, Majorana equation still going to be relevant when I go to quantum field theory? So this I have to look, you know, take some quantum field theory models to see how they describe neutrinos and just. But even if you have like,
So if you did find, say, the Majorana neutrinos or some other system which had faster, which took longer to relax, so that would be good in the sense that it would provide you an opportunity for seeing deviations from quantum mechanics by studying those systems and seeing if they could bone it. But my question is, there's also an underdetermination in boning mechanics with what the guidance equation is. So you know, in the particle case, you could always add, you know, a curl term, and you know, it'll also reproduce the quantum predictions. So how sensitive are any of these conclusions to the particular way in which you choose to resolve that underdetermination by, you know, looking at the simplest guidance equation or just eliminating those terms? You've looked at relaxation for those kinds of things. Do they have a large impact?
Well, if you consider like non-relativistic system, if you add these extra curl terms, then you have faster relaxation to quantum equilibrium.
Right. So even if you predicted, I assume there's an analog of the curl term for the Majorana system. So even if you predicted that in the absence of the curl term, things would relax very slowly, if you go to the lab and you find nothing unusual, you can say, oh, well, you know, that's just because actually there's a different guidance equation.
Okay, but then you need to come up with like good physical argument to select, one Dirac Bohm-like model with respect to another one. So maybe you can add some extra curl term, but maybe it's slightly artificial or it violates a certain symmetry or something like this. And maybe you can just simply say that the one that I had in the first place is much more natural than the. You have to come with additional, like maybe a bit like Howard Wiseman did in his paper, you know, paper on weak measurements. So he had some way to select one possibility versus the other.
No more questions. Let's thank Samuel again.